Hello, welcome to the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine Audio Abstracts. I'm Dr. Erin Bennett, and on behalf of PCCM, I'm happy to present this audio recording of the research abstracts that appear in this month's issue. Let's get started. Abstract 1 is a late breaker article by Chung et al. Early Rehabilitation in Critically Ill Children, a two-center implementation study. Objectives: to implement an early rehabilitation bundle in two Canadian PICUs. Design and setting: implementation study in the PICUs at McMaster Children's Hospital, Site 1, and London Health Sciences, Site 2. Patients: all children under 18 years old admitted to the PICU were eligible for the intervention. Interventions: a bundle consisting of 1. Analgesia and first sedation, 2. Delirium monitoring and prevention, and 3. Early mobilization. Measurements and main results: primary outcomes were the duration of implementation, bundle compliance, process of care, safety, and the factors influencing implementation. Secondary endpoints were the impact of the bundle on clinical outcomes such as pain, delirium, iatrogenic withdrawal, ventilator-free days, length of stay, and mortality. Implementation occurred over 26 months, from August 2018 to October 2020. Data were collected on 1,036 patients representing 4,065 patient days. Bundle compliance was optimized within 6 months of rollout. Goal setting for mobilization and level of arousal improved significantly, with a p-value of less than 0.01. In Site 1, benzodiazepine patient exposure days decreased by 23.2%, with a 95% confidence interval of 30.8 to 15.5%. Opioid patient exposure days decreased by 26.1%, with a 95% confidence interval of 34.8 to 17.4%, and dexmedetomidine patient exposure days decreased by 9.2%, with a 95% confidence interval of 18.2 to 0.2%. At Site 2, only dexmedetomidine exposure decreased significantly by 10.5% patient days, with a 95% confidence interval of 19.8 to 1.1%. Patient comfort, safety, and nursing workload were not adversely affected. There was no significant impact of the bundle on the rate of delirium, ventilator-free days, length of PICU stay, or mortality. Key facilitators to implementation included institutional support, unit-wide practice guidelines, dedicated PICU educators, easily accessible resources, and family engagement. Conclusions: a rehabilitation bundle can improve processes of care and reduce patient sedative exposure without increasing patient discomfort, nursing workload, or harm. We did not observe an impact on short-term clinical outcomes. The efficacy of a PICU rehabilitation bundle requires ongoing study. Lessons learned in this study provide evidence to inform rehabilitation implementation in the PICU setting. Abstract 2 is a late-breaker article by Harley et al. Resuscitation with Early Adrenaline Infusion for Children with Septic Shock, a Randomized Pilot Trial. Objectives: in children with septic shock, guidelines recommend resuscitation with 40 to 60 milliliters per kilogram of fluid boluses, yet there is a lack of evidence to support this practice. We aim to determine the feasibility of a randomized trial comparing early adrenaline infusion with standard fluid resuscitation in children with septic shock. Design: open-label, parallel, randomized, controlled, multi-center pilot study. The primary endpoint was feasibility. The exploratory clinical endpoint was survival free of organ dysfunction by 28 days. Setting: 4 pediatric emergency departments in Queensland, Australia. Patients: children between 28 days and 18 years old with septic shock. Interventions: patients were assigned 1-to-1 to receive a continuous adrenaline infusion after 20 milliliters per kilogram fluid bolus resuscitation with an N equal to 17, or standard care fluid resuscitation defined as delivery of 40 to 60 milliliters per kilogram of fluid bolus resuscitation prior to inotrope commencement with an N equal to 23. Measurements and main results: 40 of 58 eligible patients, or 69%, were consented with a median age of 3.7 years with an interquartile range of 0.9 to 12.1 years. The median time from randomization to inotropes was 16 minutes with an interquartile range of 12 to 26 minutes in the intervention group and 49 minutes with an interquartile range of 29 to 63 minutes in the standard care group. The median amount of fluid delivered during the first 24 hours in the intervention group was 0 milliliters per kilogram with an interquartile range of 0 to 10 milliliters per kilogram and 20 milliliters per kilogram in the standard care group with an interquartile range of 14.6 to 28.6 milliliters per kilogram with a difference of negative 20 and a 95% confidence interval of negative 28 to negative 12. The number of days alive and free of organ dysfunction did not differ between the intervention and standard care groups, with a median of 27 days and an interquartile range of 26 to 27 days versus 26 days with an interquartile range of 25 to 27 days. There were no adverse events reported associated with the intervention. Conclusions. In children with septic shock, a protocol comparing early administration of adrenaline versus standard care achieved separation between the study arms in relation to inotrope and fluid bolus use. Abstract 3 is a late-breaker article by Mills et al., Stress Ulcer Prophylaxis versus Placebo, a blinded pilot randomized control trial to evaluate the safety of two strategies in critically ill infants with congenital heart disease. Objectives. The routine use of stress ulcer prophylaxis in infants with congenital heart disease in the cardiac ICU or CICU is controversial. We aim to conduct a pilot study to explore the feasibility of performing a subsequent larger trial to assess the safety and efficacy of withholding stress ulcer prophylaxis in this population. Design, setting, and patients. Single-center, prospective, double-blinded, parallel group, stress ulcer prophylaxis versus placebo, randomized controlled pilot trial in infants with congenital heart disease admitted to the cardiac ICU and anticipated to require respiratory support for greater than 24 hours. Interventions. Patients were randomized 1-to-1, stratified by age and admission type, to receive a histamine 2 receptor antagonist or placebo until respiratory support was discontinued up to 14 days or transfer from the CICU if earlier. Measurements and main results. Feasibility was defined a priori by thresholds of screening rate, consent rate, timely drug allocation, and protocol adherence. The safety outcome was the rate of clinically significant upper gastrointestinal or upper GI bleeding. We screened 1,426 patients from February 2019 to March 2022. Of 132 eligible patients, we gained informed consent in 70 or 53%. Two patients did not require CICU admission after obtaining consent, and the remaining 68 patients were randomized to stress ulcer prophylaxis with an N equal to 34 or to placebo with an N equal to 34. 10 patients were withdrawn early because of a change in eligibility with an N equal to 3 or open label stress ulcer prophylaxis use with an N equal to 7 or 10%. Study procedures were completed in 58 patients or 89% protocol adherence. All feasibility criteria were met. There were no clinically significant episodes of upper GI bleeding during the pilot randomized control trial. The percentage of patients with other non-serious adverse events did not differ between groups. Conclusions. Withholding of stress ulcer prophylaxis in infants with congenital heart disease admitted to the CICU was feasible. A larger multicenter randomized control trial designed to confirm the safety of this intervention and its impact on incidence of upper GI bleeding, gastrointestinal microbiome, and other clinical outcomes is warranted. Abstract 4 is a feature article by Tager et al. Challenges of Families of Patients Hospitalized in the PICU, a pre-planned secondary analysis from the Navigate dataset. Objectives. To describe challenges experienced by parents of children hospitalized in the PICU during PICU admission as reported by family navigators. Design. A pre-planned secondary analysis of open response data coded via inductive qualitative approach from the Navigate randomized control trial. Setting. Two university-affiliated PICUs in the Midwestern United States as part of a randomized control trial. Patients. 224 parents of 190 PICU patients. Interventions. In 2015 to 2017, trained family navigators assessed and addressed parent needs, offered weekly family meetings, and provided post-PICU discharge parent check-ins as part of a study investigating the effectiveness of a communication support intervention. Measurements and main results. We analyzed qualitative data recorded by family navigators weekly across 338 encounters. Navigators described families' biggest challenge, communication challenges, and ways the team could better support the family. We used an inductive qualitative coding approach and a modified member checking exercise. The most common difficulties included home life in 45.2%, hospitalization in 29%, and diagnosis distress in 17.2%. Navigators often identified that parents had co-occurring challenges. Communication was identified as a biggest challenge for 8% of families. Communication challenges with families included lack of information in 7%, team communication in 4.8%, and communication quality in 4.8%. Suggestions for improving care included better medical communication, listening, rapport, and resources. Conclusions. This study describes families' experiences and challenges assessed throughout the PICU stay. Family navigators reported families frequently experienced stressors, both internal and external to the hospital environment, and communication challenges between families and providers may be additional sources of distress. Further research should develop and assess interventions aimed at improving provider-family communication and reducing stressors outside of the hospital itself, such as home life difficulties. Abstract 5 is a feature article by Van Dam et al. Tracheal Intubation by Advanced Practice Registered Nurses in Pediatric Critical Care, Retrospective Study from the National Emergency Airway for Children Registry. Objectives: to describe tracheal intubation practice by advanced practice registered nurses in North American PICUs, including rates of tracheal intubation associated events from 2015 to 2019. Design and setting. Retrospective study using the National Emergency Airway Registry for Children with all tracheal intubations performed in PICU and pediatric cardiac ICU between January 2015 and December 2019. The primary outcome was first attempt tracheal intubation success rate. Secondary outcomes were tracheal intubation associated events, severe tracheal intubation associated events, and hypoxemia. Subjects: critically ill children requiring tracheal intubation in a PICU or pediatric cardiac ICU. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Among 11,012 tracheal intubations, advanced practice registered nurses, or APRNs, performed 1,626, or 14.7%. Overall, tracheal intubation by APRNs compared with other clinicians occurred less frequently in patients with known difficult airway, 11.1% versus 14.3% with a p-value less than 0.001, but more frequently in infants younger than 1 year old, 55.9% versus 44.4% with a p-value less than 0.0001, and in patients with cardiac disease, 26.3% versus 15.9% with a p-value less than 0.0001. There was lower odds of success in first attempt tracheal intubation for APRNs versus other clinicians, with an adjusted odds ratio of 0.7 and a 95% confidence interval of 0.62 to 0.79. We failed to identify a difference in rates of tracheal intubation associated events, severe tracheal intubation associated events, and oxygen desaturation events for tracheal intubations by APRNs compared with other clinicians. The tracheal intubation first attempt success rate improved with APRN experience. Less than 1 year was 54.2%, 1 to 5 years was 59.4%, 6 to 10 years was 67.6%, and greater than 10 years was 63.1%, with a p-value equal to 0.021. Conclusions. Tracheal intubation performed by APRNs was associated with lower odds of first attempt success when compared with other ICU clinicians, although there was no appreciable difference in procedural adverse events. There appears to be a positive relationship between experience and success rates. These data suggest there is an ongoing need for opportunities to build on tracheal intubation competency with APRNs. Abstract 6 is a feature article by Gladden et al. Adverse tracheal intubation events in critically ill, underweight, and obese children. Retrospective study of the National Emergency Airway for Children Registry, 2013 to 2020. Objectives. Extremes of patient body mass index are associated with difficult intubation and increased morbidity in adults. We aim to determine the association between being underweight or obese with adverse airway outcomes, including adverse tracheal intubation associated events, and or peri-intubation hypoxemia, defined as pulse oximetry oxygen saturation less than 80% in critically ill children. Design and setting. Retrospective cohort using the National Emergency Airway for Children Registry dataset of 2013 to 2020. Patients included critically ill children 0 to 17 years old undergoing tracheal intubation in PICUs. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Registry data from 24,342 patients who underwent tracheal intubation between 2013 and 2020 were analyzed. Patients were categorized using the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention weight for age chart. 57.1% were normal weight or 5th to 84th percentile, 27.5% were underweight or less than 5th percentile, 7.2% were overweight or 85th to less than 95th percentile, and 8.2% were obese or greater than or equal to the 95th percentile. Underweight was most common in infants in 34%. Obesity was most common in children older than 8 years old in 15.1%. Underweight patients more often had oxygenation and ventilation failure as the indication for tracheal intubation in 34% and 36.2%, and 16.7% had a history of difficult airway. Apneic oxygenation was used more often in overweight and obese patients in 19.1% and 19.6% respectively than in underweight or normal weight patients, 14.1% and 17.1% respectively, with a p-value less than 0.001. Tracheal intubation-associated events and/or hypoxemia occurred more often in underweight and obese patients, 27.1% and 24.3% respectively, with a p-value less than 0.001. Tracheal intubation in underweight children was associated with greater odds of adverse airway outcomes compared with normal weight children after adjusting for potential confounders. The underweight adjusted odds ratio was 1.09 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.01 to 1.18 and a p-value equal to 0.016. Both underweight and obesity were associated with hypoxemia after adjusting for covariates and site clustering. The underweight adjusted odds ratio was 1.11 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.02 to 1.21 and a p-value equal to 0.01. And the obesity adjusted odds ratio was 1.22 with a 95% confidence interval of 1.07 to 1.39 and a p-value equal to 0.002. Conclusions. In underweight and obese children compared with normal weight children, procedures around the timing of tracheal intubation are associated with greater odds of adverse airway events. Abstract 7 is a PCCM trial by Schlappbach et al. Resuscitation with vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine in children with septic shock, a multicenter randomized pilot study. Objectives. Adjunctive therapy with vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine has been evaluated in adults, but randomized controlled trial data in children are lacking. We aim to test the feasibility of vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine in PICU patients with septic shock, and to explore whether the intervention is associated with increased survival, free of organ dysfunction. Design. Open-label, parallel, pilot, randomized controlled trial multicenter study. The primary endpoint was feasibility. Clinical endpoints included survival free of organ dysfunction censored at 28 days and 9 secondary outcomes, shock reversal, and 2 proxy measures of intervention efficacy. Setting: 6 PICUs in Australia and New Zealand. Patients: children between 28 days and 18 years of age requiring vasoactive drugs for septic shock between August 2019 and March 2021. Interventions: patients were assigned 1-to-1 to receive 1 mg per kilogram of hydrocortisone every 6 hours, 30 mg per kilogram of ascorbic acid every 6 hours, and 4 mg per kilogram of thiamine every 12 hours, or standard septic shock management. The N for thiamine was 27, and the N for standard septic shock management was 33. Measurements and main results. 60 of 77 or 78% eligible patients consented, with 91% of approached parents providing consent. The median time from randomization to intervention was 44 minutes, with an interquartile range of 29 to 120 minutes. 8 of 27, or 30% of patients in the intervention group, and 9 of 33, or 27% in the standard group, had received IV steroids before randomization. Median survival alive and free of organ dysfunction was 20 days in the intervention group, with an interquartile range of 0 to 26 days, and 21 days in the standard care group, with an interquartile range of 0 to 25 days. Median PICU length of stay was 5.3 days in the intervention group, with an interquartile range of 2.5 to 11.3 days, versus 6.9 days in the control group, with an interquartile range of 3 to 11.5 days. Shock reversal occurred at a median of 35.2 hours in the intervention group, with an interquartile range of 14.6 to 101.2 hours, versus 47.3 hours in the standard care group, with an interquartile range of 22.4 to 106.8 hours, with a median difference of negative 12 hours and a 95% confidence interval of negative 56.8 to 32.7 hours. Conclusions. In children requiring vasopressors for septic shock, a protocol comparing adjunctive treatment with high-dose vitamin C, hydrocortisone, and thiamine versus standard care was feasible. These findings assist in making modifications to the trial protocol to enable a better-designed, larger randomized control trial. Abstract 8 is a brief report by McWinney et al. Serum levels of vitamin C and thiamine in children with suspected sepsis, a prospective observational cohort study. Objectives. Vitamin C and thiamine have been trialed as adjunctive therapies in adults with septic shock, but their role in critically ill children is unclear. We assessed serum levels of vitamin C and thiamine in children evaluated for sepsis. Design. Single-center prospective observational study. Serum levels of vitamin C and thiamine were measured on admission, and association with multiple organ dysfunction syndrome, or MODS, was explored using logistic regression. Setting. Emergency department and PICU in a tertiary children's hospital, Queensland, Australia. Patients included children greater than 1 month and less than 17 years evaluated for sepsis. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Vitamin levels were determined in 221 children with a median age of 3.5 years with an interquartile range of 1.6 to 8.3 years. Vitamin C levels were inversely correlated with severity as measured by pediatric sequential organ failure assessment, with Spearman's rho equal to negative 0.16 and a p-value equal to 0.018. Median vitamin C levels on admission were the following by group: 35.7 micromoles per liter with an interquartile range of 17.9 to 54.1 micromoles per liter in children without organ dysfunction, 36.1 micromoles per liter with an interquartile range of 21.4 to 53.7 micromoles per liter in children with single organ dysfunction, and 17.9 micromoles per liter with an interquartile range of 6.6 to 43 micromoles per liter in children with MODS, with a p-value equal to 0.017. In multivariable analyses, low levels of vitamin C at the time of sampling were associated with greater odds of MODS. With an adjusted odds ratio of 3.04 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.51 to 6.12. And vitamin C deficiency was associated with greater odds of MODS at 24 hours after sampling, with an adjusted odds ratio of 3.38 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.53 to 7.47. Median thiamine levels by group were the following: 162 nanomoles per liter with an interquartile range of 138 to 192 nanomoles per liter in children without organ dysfunction, 185 nanomoles per liter with an interquartile range of 143 to 200 nanomoles per liter in children with single organ dysfunction, and 136 nanomoles per liter with an interquartile range of 110 to 179 nanomoles per liter in children with MODS, with a p-value equal to 0.061. We failed to identify an association between thiamine deficiency at either MODS at sampling or MODS at 24 hours. The odds ratio for MODS at sampling was 2.52 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.15 to 40.86. The odds ratio for MODS at 24 hours was 2.96 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.18 to 48.18. Conclusions. Critically ill children evaluated for sepsis frequently manifest decreased levels of vitamin C, with lower levels associated with higher severity. Abstract 9 is an online clinical investigation by Mel et al. Utility of hospital failure to rescue for analyzing variation in pediatric postoperative mortality. Objectives: to evaluate the association between pediatric hospital performances in terms of failure to rescue, defined as postoperative mortality after a surgical complication, and mortality among patients without a surgical complication. Design: retrospective cohort study. Setting: 48 academic pediatric hospitals. Data obtained from the Pediatric Health Information System database. Child Health Corporation of America, Shawnee Mission, Kansas, 2012 to 2020. Patients: children who underwent at least one of 57 high-risk operations associated with significant postoperative mortality. Hospitals were stratified into quintiles of reliability-adjusted failure to rescue, with lower-than-average failure to rescue in quintile 1 and higher-than-average failure to rescue in quintile 5. Multivariable hierarchical regression was used to evaluate the association between hospital failure to rescue performance and mortality among patients who did not have a surgical complication. Measurements and main results. Among 203,242 children treated across 48 academic hospitals, the complication and overall postoperative mortality rates were 8.8% and 2.3%, respectively. Among patients who had a complication, the failure to rescue rate was 8.8%. Among patients who did not have a complication, the mortality rate was 1.7%. There was a 6.5-fold increase in reliability-adjusted failure to rescue between the lowest and highest performing hospitals. The lowest failure to rescue hospital was 2.7% with a 95% confidence interval of 1.6 to 3.9, and the highest failure to rescue hospital was 17.8% with a 95% confidence interval of 16.8 to 18.8. Complex chronic conditions were highly prevalent across hospitals. Quintile 1 was 72.7%, quintile 2 was 73.8%, quintile 3 was 72.2%, quintile 4 was 74%, and quintile 5 was 74.8%. Trend test p-value was less than 0.01. Relative to quintile 1 hospitals, the odds of mortality in the absence of a postoperative complication significantly increased by 33% at quintile 5 hospitals, with an odds ratio of 1.33 and a 95% confidence interval of 1.07 to 1.66. This association was consistent when limited to patients with a complex chronic condition and neonates. Conclusion: failure to rescue may be a useful and valid surgical quality measure for pediatric surgery, even when considering patients without a postoperative complication. These findings suggest practices and processes for preventing failure to rescue at high-performing pediatric hospitals might help mitigate the risk of postoperative mortality, even in the absence of a postoperative complication. Abstract 10 is an online clinical investigation by McCluskey et al. Suicide and Self-Harm in Adolescents During the COVID-19 Pandemic, a U.S. Virtual Pediatric Systems LLC database study of PICU admissions from 2016 to 2021. Objectives: to characterize the epidemiology of suicide and self-harm among adolescents admitted to PICUs during the first 2 years of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States. Design: descriptive analysis of a large multi-center quality-controlled database, Virtual Pediatric Systems, or VPS, and of a national public health dataset, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention web-based wide-ranging online data for epidemiology research, or CDC Wonder. Setting: the 69 PICUs participating in the VPS database that contributed data for the entire study period, January 1, 2016 to December 31, 2021. Patients: adolescents older than 12 years to younger than 18 years old admitted to a participating PICU during the study period with a diagnosis involving self-harm or a suicide attempt in the VPS sample, or adolescent suicide deaths over the same period in the CDC Wonder sample. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results: we identified 10,239 suicide deaths and 7,692 PICU admissions for self-harm, including 5,414 admissions in the pre-pandemic period, 2016 to 2020, and 2,278 in the pandemic period, 2020 to 2021. Compared with the pre-pandemic period, there was no increase in the median number of suicide deaths per quarter, 429 with an interquartile range of 399 to 453 versus 416 with an interquartile range of 390 to 482, and no increase in the median of PICU admissions for self-harm per quarter, 315 with an interquartile range of 289 to 353 versus 310 with an interquartile range of 286 to 387 in the pandemic period. There was an increase in the ratio of self-harm PICU admissions to all-cause PICU admissions per quarter during the pandemic, 1.98 with an interquartile range of 1.43 to 2.12 compared with the pre-pandemic period per quarter, 1.59 with an interquartile range of 1.46 to 1.74. We also observed a significant decrease in all-cause PICU admissions per quarter early in the pandemic compared with the pre-pandemic period, 16,026 with an interquartile range of 13,721 to 16,297 versus 19,607 with an interquartile range of 18,371 to 20,581. Conclusions: the number of suicide deaths and PICU admissions per quarter for self-harm remained relatively constant during the pandemic, while the number of all-cause PICU admissions per quarter decreased compared with the pre-pandemic period. The resultant higher ratio of self-harm admissions to all-cause PICU admissions may have contributed to the perception that more adolescents required critical care for mental health-related conditions early in the pandemic. Abstract 11 is an online clinical investigation by Sachet et al. Hospital-acquired venous thromboembolism and invasive mechanical ventilation, a report from the Children's Hospital-Acquired Thrombosis Consortium. Objectives: to determine if the duration of invasive mechanical ventilation, or IMV, was associated with hospital-acquired venous thromboembolism, or hospital-acquired VTE, among critically ill children. Design: a multicenter matched case control study as a secondary analysis of Children's Hospital-Acquired Thrombosis, or CHAT, consortium registry. Setting: PICUs within U.S. CHAT consortium participating centers. Patients: children younger than 21 years old admitted to a PICU receiving IMV for greater than or equal to 1 day duration from January 2012 to March 2022 were included for study. Cases with hospital-acquired VTE were matched 1 to 2 to controls without hospital-acquired VTE by patient age groups, younger than 1, 1 to 12, and older than 12 years. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. The primary outcome was IMV duration in days. Descriptive data included demographics, anthropometrics, hospital-acquired VTE characteristics, IDEST type, location, and timing, central venous catheterization data, thromboprophylaxis practices, and Braden-Q mobility scores. Descriptive, comparative, and associative statistics were employed, including multivariate conditional logistic regression for hospital-acquired VTE. A total of 152 cases were matched to 304 controls. Cases with hospital-acquired VTE were diagnosed at a median of 7 days with an interquartile range of 3 to 16 days after IMV. The hospital-acquired VTE were limb deep venous thromboses in 130 of 152, or 85.5%, and frequently central venous catheterization related in 111 of 152, or 73%. As compared to controls, cases with hospital-acquired VTE experienced a longer length of stay, with a median of 34 days and an interquartile range of 18 to 62 days versus 11.5 days and an interquartile range of 6 to 21 days with a p-value less than 0.001, and cases with hospital-acquired VTE also experienced longer IMV duration, with a median of 7 days and an interquartile range of 4 to 15 days versus 4 days and an interquartile range of 1 to 7 days with a p-value less than 0.001. In a multivariate logistic model, greater IMV duration was independently associated with hospital-acquired VTE, with an adjusted odds ratio of 1.09, a 95% confidence interval of 1.01 to 1.17, and a p-value equal to 0.023. Conclusions: among critically ill children undergoing IMV, hospital-acquired VTE was associated with greater IMV duration. If prospectively validated, IMV duration should be included as part of prothrombotic risk stratification and future pediatric thromboprophylaxis trials. Abstract 12 is an online cardiac intensive care article by Broden et al. Dying and Death in a Pediatric Cardiac ICU: Mixed Methods Evaluation of Multidisciplinary Staff Responses. Objectives: understanding factors influencing quality of pediatric end-of-life care is necessary to identify interventions to improve family and staff experiences. We characterized pediatric cardiac ICU staff free text survey responses to contextualize patterns in quality of dying and death scoring. Design: this mixed method study reports on a cross-sectional survey of pediatric cardiac ICU staff involved in patient deaths. Setting: single quaternary pediatric cardiac ICU from 2019 to 2021. Participants: multidisciplinary staff, including bedside nurses, allied health professionals, and medical practitioners, rated quality of dying and death and voluntarily added free text responses. We derived descriptive characteristics of free text responses using content analysis. Response sentiment was classified as positive, negative, or both positive and negative. We compared category and sentiment frequency by discipline, end-of-life medical intensity, years of experience, and quality of dying and death score quartiles. There were no interventions. Measurements and main results. Of 60 deaths and 713 completed staff surveys, 269 or 38% contained free text responses, including 103 of 269 or 38% from nurses. Of six qualitative categories, IDEST relational dynamics, clinical circumstances, family experiences, emotional expressions, temporal conditions, and structural and situational factors, relational dynamics were most frequent, 173 responses. When compared by discipline, family experiences were more common in nursing responses than medical practitioners or allied health. High intensity was associated with infrequent discussion of family experience and greater focus on temporal conditions and clinical circumstances. Emotional expressions and temporal conditions were more common in lowest quality of dying and death quartile surveys. Although 45% staff responses contained both sentiments, relational dynamics and family experiences were more likely positive. Negative sentiments were more common in the lowest quality of dying and death quartile surveys and responses containing temporal conditions or structural and situational factors. Conclusions: synergistic relationships between the multidisciplinary team and family shaped clinicians' positive responses. Attention to team dynamics may be a crucial ingredient in interventions to improve end-of-life care. Our data support that team-based education initiatives should consider differential foci between disciplines and end-of-life characteristics. This concludes the abstracts for the February 2024 issue of Pediatric Critical Care Medicine. Thank you very much for listening. For more journal-related content, including access to the articles mentioned in this recording, please visit pccmjournal.org. Members of the SCCM Pediatric Section receive complimentary access to the PCCM Journal.